www.wbai.org.
Morning. It's 7 a.m. and 28 degrees in Central Park. We'll see a high near 42 and it will be sunny. This Friday, January 8th, 2020, you're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial free speech radio, WBAI New York. And I'm coming to you from the Dominican Republic. Coming up next, a new day. To help us understand this moment, we turn to two very different but interrelated perspectives on the events of January 6th from colleagues whose work I value and respect. First, we'll hear a brief recorded assessment from William Robinson, professor of sociology at UC Santa Barbara and very sharp Marxist. Then we'll welcome back to the show Dr. Bandy Lee, forensic psychiatrist at Yale University of Medicine. Stay tuned for headlines and the COVID-19 assessment of the pandemic.
Like I'm longing to live. I wish I could do all the things that I can do, though I'm way overdue. I'd be starting anew. Well, I wish I could be like a bird in the sky. How sweet.
And this is your update on the COVID-19 pandemic. Those who qualify can now register for appointments online for COVID-19 vaccinations at distribution sites opening up in New York City this weekend. The sites will run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And Mayor Bill de Blasio doubled down on his claim that the state is slowing down the process. He says, oh no. The mayor is calling for state approval to vaccinate thousands of first responders not designated in the first group authorized to receive the vaccine. The city has been inoculating healthcare workers, nursing home employees and residents, members of the fire department and EMS. However, Mayor de Blasio says the city is ready and wants to inoculate anyone over the age of 75, police officers, and corrections officers. Right now, those groups are Category 1B, under federal guidelines, that is. But the mayor used a slide to illustrate that those officers and other persons do perform many of the very same functions designated by the state as the highest risk close contact. That includes CPR, controlling bleeding, administering Narcan, and other initial medical treatment during emergencies. And as I was reading this earlier, I was thinking, this is precisely why we can't abolish the police, because the police should not be administering CPR, controlling bleeding, and administering Narcan. Medical technicians should be doing that, not people charged with repressing the people at the bottom of society. And certainly not people who are going to let the white supremacists take over the world and, in fact, take selfies with them. Mayor de Blasio says the city is, in essence, being micromanaged.
We understand what we can do on the ground in our own communities. Give us that freedom, because everyone agrees on one thing. We want the maximum number of high-priority people vaccinated. Sometimes the federal government, the state government, need to stand back and let local government do what it knows how to do best. This is one of those times.
The mayor also said there are thousands of vaccines available for those in Group 1A that are authorized to receive the vaccine. Those qualified can register for a vaccine on the city's website. And starting on Monday, a phone-in reservation system will also be up and running. And turning to national news, as shocking images of insurrectionists loyal to Donald Trump stormed the U.S. Capitol, blowing past the Capitol Police Wednesday, black activists, legislators, and scholars see racial disparity. They were among many to quickly point to the contrast between law enforcement's response to the mostly white rioters and what happened during racial justice protests last summer. Here's California Congresswoman Karen Bass, followed by organizer Candace Bailey.
Well, it was an extremely sad day. I will tell you that I was very worried about the protesters and told my family not to worry about me because I was going to be in the safest building in the country, in the Capitol. It turns out I was in the most dangerous place to be. I just can't help but saying the difference between how these protesters were received, how unprepared the Capitol was, versus how they have responded when it's a Black Lives Matter protest, was just absolutely shocking.
I guess I wish I could say I was surprised at the reaction, but I don't feel like I am. I knew that the response would be completely different than it would be if someone my color or from the opposite side of the fence was doing the same exact things.
And the National Guard was not called until after the breach of U.S. Capitol security occurred. And I've been told and have read, and we must confirm, that they had no guns. Not that I'm a proponent of cops carrying guns, because cops don't carry guns in other parts of the world. But they carry guns whenever people of color or demonstrations or strikes are involved. Metropolitan State University of Denver professor of criminal justice and criminology Kevin Smith said, quote, by the time they got to the Capitol, it was too late.
When they started to march to the Capitol, it was too late. By the time they got there, it was already too late to make any calls. Now you have to do what we call triage in terms of trying to clean things up after the fact.
And did the police know? The police had to know exactly what was coming. It was foreseeable, and the Capitol Police failed to act. That is the issue. Why did the police know? What did the police know? And when did they know it? And those are the words of our producer, Ajamu Sankova, who's an attorney. What did the police know, and when did they know? Trump supporters telescoped what they were planning for weeks online. They described their violent chaos for January 6th in detail, in fact. They showed the weapons they would carry in Washington, D.C., which, by the way, has the strictest gun laws in the country. It is literally unbelievable that the Capitol Police did not know what was going on. Like, that word unbelievable that we use all of the time is appropriate in this moment. For weeks, President Trump and his supporters had been proclaiming January 6, 2021 as a day of reckoning, a day to gather in Washington to, quote, save America and, quote, stop the steal of the election that Trump had decisively lost, but which he still maintained, often through a toxic brew of conspiracy theories, that he had won by a landslide. And when that day came, the president rallied thousands of his supporters with an incendiary speech. Then a large mob of those supporters, many waving Trump flags, Confederate flags, and wearing Trump regalia, violently stormed the Capitol to take over the halls of government and send elected officials into hiding, fearing for their safety. Although the question is, what was the purpose of that attempt at storming the Capitol and taking over? What's fascinating is that this is the only moment in history that you take a Capitol building, state building, not for the purpose of revolution, but for the purpose of reinstating a corrupt, self-absorbed president who has legislated in the interests of the ruling class. But if the chaos in the Capitol shocked the country, one of the most disturbing aspects of this most disturbing day was that it could be seen coming. The president himself had all but circled it on the nation's calendar, literally. He did everything but circle the damn thing on the nation's calendar. Big protest in D.C. on January 6th, he says. This is Trump. Quote, big protest in D.C. on January 6th. He tweeted this on December 9th, just one of several of his tweets promoting the day. The other, quote, be there, will be wild, unquote. But the most disturbing aspect of it was that it might have been an inside job. And here are the latest. That's the most disturbing aspect of it. What is this question? Was this an inside job? And here are the latest. A Capitol Police officer was killed by a flash bomb in D.C. that day. And two pipe bombs were found, one in front of the DNC and one was found in front of the RNC. Both were deactivated by police. And actually, they were detonated by police. Pelosi and Schumer have called for Trump's immediate removal via the 25th Amendment or impeachment. And two cabinet officers have resigned. So two executive members of the executive government of transportation, Elaine Chao, and in education, Betsy DeVos. And you probably heard by now that there have been other pro-Trump protests at throughout the country in U.S. The state capitals. L.A. pro-Trump and anti-Trump protesters gathered at Los Angeles City Hall at 1 p.m. Yesterday, I believe. And Washington State also had protests shortly before 3 p.m. Pro-Trump protesters gained access to the grounds of the Washington State Governor's Mansion in Olympia, Washington. And in Oregon, altercations erupted at the Oregon Capitol in Salem, despite repeated attempts to keep opposing groups from converging toward violence. And in Utah, about 400 Trump supporters came together at the Utah Capitol in Salt Lake City. And in Michigan, 700 to 800 people came to the lawn of Michigan's Capitol in Lansing, some bringing rifles and Stop the Steal signs. And this is reported by the Detroit Free Press. And other capitals where pro-Trump protesters arrived include Georgia, Colorado, Minnesota, and Arizona. And it's 7:15 and 29 degrees in Central Park, and you're tuned to listener sponsor WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. And I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of A New Day, coming to you live from the Dominican Republic, where I traveled to just last night. That was Hey Hey, played by techno marching band Mo. I think that's the pronunciation of that title. But this was a beautiful song chosen by our producer, Ellis Maxwell. And turning to our interview for today, my own assessment of the events of January 6th remain fragmented. But what is clear to all of us is that the country is in deep crisis. Its citizens are alienated from themselves and each other. The country is in a state of moral decay and is unraveling. This might have been the word used by one of our callers yesterday, Ma'at, from the cave. In a separate but thematically related development, the New York Post reported that thousands of young New Yorkers are reveling in packed parties in the middle of a pandemic, and they're in fact calling them COVID parties. In order to help us understand this moment, we turn to two very different but interrelated perspectives from colleagues whose work I value and respect. First, we'll hear a brief recorded assessment of the January 6th events from William Robinson, professor of sociology at UC Santa Barbara. Let's listen.
Dr. William Robinson, it's so wonderful to have you on the show again. And my basic question is, was this an infantile coup or a real fascist threat?
Thank you for having me on the program. Absolutely, the threat is real. Obviously, this was a minor attempt at a coup, and in that sense, it was infantile. But the larger picture here, the threat is very real, and this is only going to get worse. Liberals have fooled themselves into thinking that when Biden takes office now, this crisis is all over. And it's totally to the contrary. You know, what we're seeing is really unprecedented. First, we're seeing a crisis within the ruling class in the United States, a crisis which is the worst, I would say the worst crisis internal to the ruling class since the Civil War. Secondly, we're seeing a crisis in the capitalist state. And a third, of course, we're in the midst of a pandemic crisis. We're in the midst of an acute global economic crisis and also a global political crisis of state legitimacy and capitalist hegemony. And this is being experienced currently with incredible intensity here in the United States. So the structural underpinnings of a fascist mobilization and this polarization into a left and a far extreme right, those structural underpinnings are still there and they're actually becoming aggravated. It's this general crisis of capitalism and capitalist rule. So this problem isn't going anywhere.
Can you tell us about this crisis of legitimacy, the fact that there was no political leadership, no one in office, in bourgeois politics that could be counted on to redirect the ship?
Absolutely. You know, what we can say is that within the Republican Party, the Republican political elite is divided between those that are willing to support a fascist option when they start losing control and to push forward a far-right agenda, and those that are not ready to do that. That's within the Republican Party. But, you know, I can say that there are three, if you want to, we want to put it like this, there's these three big groups we can identify as we analyze today's event. And the first is, of course, the political, within the political elite, is the Republicans, and I just commented on that. The Republican Party has long since been captured by its far-right wing, which is pretty much fascist or neo-fascist or on the fringes of fascism. And Trump was this charismatic figure that came along and was able to galvanize a far-right neo-fascist response. But even if he goes, that is still there. The second group here are the Democrats. We can't forget that it was the neoliberal agenda of the Democrats, capitalist globalization pushed forward by the Democrats, going back to Clinton and continuing under Obama, and will now continue if there's not some mass pressure from below to push in a different direction, the Biden administration and that capitalist globalization, this neoliberal capitalism in the United States and worldwide is what has so devastated working and poor people in the United States, including significant white sectors of the working class, and pushed those white sectors into a situation where they've been easily manipulated and mobilized by a fascist right. And the third, because I'm mentioning if we want to analyze today's events, you know, in a larger structural and political context, the third big group here to talk about is the left. And there is this burgeoning popular, massive popular discontent. There's this burgeoning mobilization. We just had 3 months of the George Floyd uprising. There's an uptick in strikes and popular mobilization and protest in the United States. But there is no left whatsoever that can give it guidance. And moreover, the absence of a left and also the very feeble political ideological analysis that comes across as left offers nothing to that mass base which is turning to fascism. That mass base doesn't inevitably and disproportionately white. Of course, there's the aspects of white supremacy here, absolutely. But there is a growing mass base to this fascist response to the crisis, and they don't automatically turn to a pro-Trump, to a Trumpist, to a fascist response, to a far-right response. They have to be galvanized and mobilized for that response, and they can get an alternative message from a left that will push them in a different direction, but we don't have that.
What do you think in the next 30 seconds is that message that the left must put out?
The left must put out a message in which it identifies the suffering of the vast majority of people in the United States, including poor whites and working class whites. The message is that the system itself is at fault, that neither Democrats and Republicans and neoliberalism is offering a solution, neither does nationalism, we can call it white nationalism or generally nationalism. A radical message, a radical leftist interpretation of the crisis needs to be put out there, and one which is appealing to the vast majority of people in the United States, including that would-be base of Trump's base and the would-be base of the fascist project.
Dr. William Robinson, thank you so very much for your clarity.
And that was Dr. William Robinson. I spoke to him on the day of the attempted infantile coup. He is a professor of sociology at UC Santa Barbara. And now we turn to the scholar who told us so. In May of 2017, she led a group of mental health professionals, including psychiatrists and psychologists, in a gathering at Yale University to discuss and assess a clear and present danger facing the country: the election of Donald Trump, a man who exhibited dangerously deviant behavior. She explained that Trump exhibits psychopathy. That's a lack of empathy, manipulation, denial of reality, self-aggrandizement, paranoia, attraction to violence, a tendency to keep those around him in a constant state of fear and mental chaos. And people like this have the potential to deploy evil in ways that most people cannot comprehend. Yet they do not look like monsters. That scholar is Dr. Bandy Zenobia Lee, a forensic psychiatrist at Yale University, and in particular at Yale School of Medicine, who has taught at Yale Law School for 15 years. She edited the New York Times bestseller, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, and most recently she wrote and published Profile of a Nation, Trump's Mind, America's Soul. Dr. Lee represents only the views of the World Mental Health Coalition as its president. Dr. Bandy Lee, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me back.
So let's talk about your perspective on the events of January 6th.
Yes, following the political scientist's analysis, it was interesting that it was called an infantile coup, and also that fascism was brought up. These I describe as mental pathology in the public sphere. Fascism is generally taken to be an ideology, but I, of course, as a psychiatrist, focus on the aspects of the psychology and the abnormality. Oftentimes, when a society enters a period of stress, or there are many individuals who are developmentally wounded, we see the phenomenon of fascism we see a population vulnerable to fascism. And I, of course, look at it more from the individual perspective or the dynamics that occur within the individuals, which is more of there are actually two phenomena that often happen, in that one I have termed narcissistic symbiosis within the book that you mentioned, Profile of a Nation, which is where the developmental wounds make the leader-follower relationship magnetically attractive, and it comes from pathology of first the leader who is looking for adulation to help compensate for a lack in development, usually a lack of love, and in doing so tries to project a sense of grandiose omnipotence and attracts followers that way. The followers are either because of the societal conditions or because of their own developmental wounds and their upbringing, are looking for a parental figure. And so when the two meet, the relationship is almost inseparable. They fit like lock and key, and that is very dangerous. Another phenomenon I described is shared psychosis. When you have a severely mentally impaired individual in a position of influence, then you find that the symptoms spread with an infectiousness that is far greater than simple social psychology. And even previously healthy individuals come to take on delusions, paranoia, or violence proneness from the leader and through the emotional pressures, and these symptoms travel by emotional bonds. So the solution to that is to eliminate, to break the exposure between leader and follower, and the followers generally return back to their baseline. Now, what the political scientist was describing in terms of the societal conditions that gave rise to this vulnerability in the first place, I have outlined in detail in my textbook Violence, which I term structural violence. So structural violence is the kind of conditions that are put in place in society that arrest the basically diminish individuals' ability, or usually groups of individuals, from being allowed to meet their basic needs. This leads to arrestation in development and emotional injury. And currently, the most urgent condition is economic inequality. So with the rise in economic gaps between the rich and the poor, wealth gaps and income gaps that have dramatically risen in the United States, even differently than most European nations, although others are quickly following suit, this has a psychological effect in that individuals become more vulnerable. Essentially, overall, the population comes to divide itself into superior and inferior segments, where one develops a worldview where if one is not superior, one is inferior. And that creates a dynamic where one is desperate for an identity if one is in the inferior position, which would be most in an unequal population, and desperate for their powerlessness. So when a leader comes around and falsely promises grandiose results of having returning back to some era in the past, which is usually a non-existent era, but essentially the leader is offering that they could return, we say metaphorically, to the mother's womb, so hearkening back to an earlier time where they are superior and they do not have to be plunged in feelings of inferiority and helplessness. And so this creates a very unhealthy dynamic where fascism can arise at the political level. But it's important to recognize these pathological signs in the population or in individuals that could be heightened when they are given given access to power and given an influential platform, instead of being kept out, mental health is usually a prerequisite for rationality and logical systems and a well-functioning society. And so these are different from ideologies. These are pathologies.
I'm Johanna Fernandez, and I'm speaking to Dr. Bandy Lee about the manifestations of structural violence in the psychology of the individual. Dr. Lee is forensic psychiatrist at Yale School of Medicine, and she's taught at Yale Law School for over 15 years. And you're listening to WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. And we're going to take callers in about 10 minutes, 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. So the reason why I continue to bring you back, and excuse me, Dr. Lee, but I'm in the Dominican Republic, which is the sound you hear in the background. But the reason why I keep on bringing you back is because there is politics and ideology, but there's also crazy. And we're not, as people who are active in the world, as historians, as political scientists, as activists, we want to understand everything in political and economic terms, but there is a relationship between the individual and psychology and society. And to know that structural violence on a mass scale produces an unhealthy society psychologically, that can become dangerous. I am thinking, as you were speaking, that there was this person in the Capitol who was wearing two horns. He was impersonating the Vikings. There was an enormous amount of infantile behavior that could be perceived, I mean, could be seen very clearly, and at some point we have to understand that or explain that. I'm also reminded that the suicide rate among white men in this country is higher than the suicide rates of everyone else. So let me move to our other question, which is that after the attempted insurrection, half of the Senate Republican Conference and 120 House Republicans doubled down on Trump's delusions. Most of these people are highly trained lawyers. What explains their behavior? Is this more about race than mental illness? Or is the white supremacy that they possess itself also a manifestation of mental illness?
Yes, the organization that I run, the World Mental Health Coalition, has recently put out a statement that we ought to consider racism as a societal mental disorder. It's very common for pathology to wish to be considered a different ideology, to wish to be included among healthy choices and ideas. But there is a distinct difference which specialists can tell apart. It usually takes knowledge of the psychological research as well as clinical experience to be able to distinguish what are pathological signs versus what are valid ideologies that are life-affirming and productive in society. So you mentioned the social and activist political aspects versus the individual. Well, they work synergistically because they are not in isolation. And it's very important in social movements to be able to recognize when there are signs of mental pathology, either at the individual level or the societal. And certain pathologies can occur mostly at the societal level. That includes racism, as I mentioned. Structural violence is another kind, but so is individual violence. We do not often think of violent behavior as being societal, but if we look at individuals, even the most violent individuals are not violent most of the time, and it's very hard to predict who will be violent when. But when we look at society, we can very precisely predict when violence will rise and when it will fall. And that that is most closely associated with what I called earlier structural violence. Structural violence, the inequities and socioeconomic measures, when we actually take quantifiable values of society, such as the Gini index indicating inequality, or percentiles in certain income brackets, we can also trace the quantity of violent deaths. And these studies have been done in the United States, in the UK, in other English-speaking democracies, and have been found to follow very closely, almost to the point where the graphs look identical. So it's important to note that their societal pathologies can occur. And when that happens, negotiation is almost impossible. And pathology, unlike bad ideas, can spread to highly educated individuals. No one is immune, in fact, just like any other infectious disease. And so it's important to distinguish the signs, and it is important for mental health professionals to speak up in society when they detect the signs, because pathology can often present with a mask of insanity, as a great scholar of psychopathy once described. Also sociopathy is a societally induced disorder that manifests in vulnerable individuals who become intractable in their ability to wreak havoc and bring destruction to society when they are not recognized. So I'll just put those ideas out there.
And you've been listening to the voice of Dr. Bandy Lee, and I'm Johanna Fernandez. This is WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York, and we're talking about the manifestations of structural violence in the psychology of individuals of all classes and all educational levels. When structural violence increases, the potential for violence, both collectively but also at the level of the individual, increases, but also an inability to accurately assess reality, it seems.
Yes. After a certain point, because one's internal preferred view of the world will conflict with the outer world, depending on the fragility of the person's inner sense itself, the outer world will be altered or detached from one's from relevance in one's mind according to one's inner needs, whether or not reality meets one's inner needs. And most of the time in pathology, it doesn't. So when you, especially when you have a leader who is detached from reality, you will find that the delusions and the false perceptions spread among the population.
And one thing you mentioned, which I think is important to underline, and we do have quite a number of callers, and I'm going to get to you in a minute, is that when you identify white supremacy and racism as a mental illness, a psychiatric condition, you essentially say that it's not acceptable, and it's not acceptable in the polity, and it's not just one among many healthy political choices. That would, in fact, include many of the policies of both parties for some time in the 20th and 21st century, not to mention long history of predatory capitalism, enslavement, and displacement of Native Americans. But both Democrats and Republicans and the media have accepted racist far-right policies as just part of the polity. And what I'm hearing is that that's actually not healthy or not normal. But let's go to callers. Caller, you're on the line. This is WBAI New York. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Good morning, Sister Johanna.
Good morning.
This is Zul in Nomad, Manhattan.
Welcome.
Thank you. I think this psychoanalysis that's being offered this morning is so important because here so many are divorced from reality. If the events of January 6th came as a surprise, then welcome to America, ka-ka-ka. You've been saluting a blood-soaked flag and haven't noticed the rock you're under if this is a surprise. So, Johanna, I want to invite you and Dr. Bandy Lee and all the cabal, the listeners, to join me and friends on Inauguration Day, January 20th, 2021, 8 a.m., across the street from Trump Tower, 5th Avenue between 56th and 57th Street. Come say what you need to say to the outgoing administration, what you need to say to the incoming administration, and we're going to do this as a big tent. Let's say free all truth-tellers and political prisoners. Protect our First Amendment and our right to know what government is doing in our name. So I'll speak to you further on, Johanna. Thank you so much, Dr. Bandy Lee, and I'll allow the other listeners to speak now.
Thank you so very much for joining us, Zul. And we're going to go to our next listener. You're on the line. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Good morning. This is Michael from Newark. And good morning, Johanna. Good morning to your guests and to the BAI audience. I would like to mention to you, you said the guy had Viking horns on, and symbology and cultural knowledge is very important, as we all know. And I am quite sure that definitely was not Viking. It was a buffalo robe.
Thank you.
Reason was appropriating Native American.
Native American.
And that symbology is very important. But also, the left and intellectuals have these discussions constantly about how these Trump supporters are swayed and pulled by this great leader. But they don't talk about the foundational element of the violence, that structural violence and real violence that goes on in the streets of our cities against black people constantly, in prisons, the constant assaults, the abusive nature of our society, from slavery to menstruacy, right down to today, and the discounting of if it happens to a black person, and that violence is just accepted. It's part of the foundational of the country, and that is overlooked in terms of the analysis. It's not spoken to. Just like the Democrats want to cull off Republicans to get power instead of going to the most oppressed people, the left is doing the same thing by allowing misappropriation of symbology and by not acknowledging the foundational bricks that build this thing and keep this thing together. They don't do it enough.
Thank you so...
Very sad.
Go ahead.
Very sad.
Thank you so very much, Michael, and I'm sure that Dr. Bandy Lee has something to say about that, but we're going to take another caller or two before we give it back to Dr. Bandy Lee. Dr. Lee, I'm hoping you're taking notes. I am too.
Yes.
Caller, you're on the line. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Hello?
You're on the line, WBAI.
Hello, Joanna. This is Kwesi from the Upper West Side. Dr. Lee, I've worked with psychopaths or sociopaths, not word, but, And I feel that someone like Trump, he would need intense therapy, such that it would be almost prenatal, not prenatal, but pre-educational. He would need intense nurturing on such an elemental level that it would render him almost to a child, an early childhood state, the type of nurturing he would need to learn to alter his thought patterns or to modify his thought patterns. What do you think of that?
Thank you so very much for joining the conversation. And we're going to take one more caller at least. Caller, you're on the line. Your name and where you're calling from.
Hello, I'm on the line.
You're on the line, WBAI.
Hi, Dr. Lee. I was in on the Zoom call yesterday. And my question is, when we say that racism is a mental health issue, are we setting it up so racists have a way of being excused from their behavior?
Oh, thank you so very much for that question. We have some more callers, but I want to give you enough time. We have about 5 or 6 minutes to respond. Dr. Lee.
Okay, thank you for those excellent questions. To go to the first one about how these destructive manifestations didn't start with one leader, but actually draw upon foundational wounds, I would say, of this nation, hearkening back to the white supremacist origins of when the country was founded, and the destruction that was that came about in order to found this nation. That is very much a part of all that is happening, but particularly in times of economic inequality. When one divides the world into superior and inferior and is looking for a way to find meaning, find some sense of self in a state of inferiority, it is very easy to draw upon other forms of inequality, such as racism or sexism, where one can claim oneself superior. And so I would say that the dynamics of racism and white supremacy are even more accentuated in times like this than at baseline. Obviously, these are long-standing pathologies and hidden pathologies that have not been addressed and healed. And so it is important that we heal our nation and address these issues now that they have come to light in such stark ways. I would also say that in response to an earlier statement you made, Joanna, that that societal labeling white supremacy or racism as a societal mental disorder, it allows us a framework of looking at what is disorder and what is healthy behavior. And even though one may believe that white supremacy or racism is benefiting oneself, the nation as a whole is tending in a self-destructive direction, and eventually all parties lose. Therefore, it's important that we address it as a pathology. In terms of the second question about Donald Trump needing healing, needing treatment at a very elemental phase, I appreciated that phrase, of nurturance at almost at an infantile stage, and that would be correct. What we see is that he is developmentally arrested at a very early age, and that would coincide with the history we know about him, that he was abandoned by his mother at age 2.5 and abandoned to an uncaring stern father who did not believe that emotional needs were valid. And this does give rise to very much what the belligerence and violence proneness that we see. When one is lacking in love, the next thing one may strive for is respect and adulation from large segments of the population, and still that hunger will never be quenched. But even when that is lost, when one is rejected by the nation through an election defeat, then one resorts to violence. So it goes in that order. If not love, respect. If not respect, violence. So that is what we are seeing. And yes, he is indeed in need of treatment, but unfortunately such individuals do not seek treatment unless they are forced to. And the third question, actually, Johanna, if you have the third question, could you repeat it to me?
I do not know what that third question is, but there was a, I think an important issue here is more on the relationship between structural violence and the individual, and the different kinds of structural violence perpetuated against Black people on a day-to-day basis in prisons by police, and the impact that has on society.
And I now remember it was whether or not that could allow people to be let off the hook through the excuse of mental disorder. First of all, if we're talking about an insanity defense is actually very difficult to achieve, and that's rightfully so, because even the most severely mentally impaired individuals still retain a surprising amount of free will. And so human beings are quite free. We can make decisions despite our impairments, and so an insanity defense is very rare. So what we see most of the time is that people are responsible for their actions, even criminally responsible, at the same time as having severe symptoms. And when that occurs, actually it's important to know when it occurs, because the person becomes far more capable of far more dangerous than if they were simply mentally impaired, which mental illness does not cause one to be any more dangerous than anyone without mental illness. So mental illness is not a cause of dangerousness. But
Dr.
criminal
Lee,
intent combined with mental illness can produce dangerousness.
Dr. Lee, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. You are such a jewel. You warned us very early on. I can only imagine what the folks at the American Psychological Association are saying now. Thank you so very much for your work, and we will continue this conversation. I will say this, and that is that you've told us that we need love, and we need a society that's economically and socially equal. Under the system of capitalism, all of our relationships are commodified, and it is a system that actually is fueled by inequality and structural violence. So you can conclude our listening audience what I mean by all of that. I think that at core, our system exhibits psychopathy. Thank you, Dr. Lee, and we hope to have you back to continue this discussion.
Thank you again for having me.
Thank you. This show is produced by Ajamu Sankofa, Ellis Maxwell, Andrea Hidalgo, Marcos Maldonado, and Craig Bahia. Michael G. Haskins is our board operator. We leave you with Reina Mia by Juan Luis Guerra y 440. Today is my father's birthday. He would have been 90 years old, and that is why I'm in the Dominican Republic. This song makes me cry. And if I could, I'd sing it to him. I'm Johanna Fernandez. See you next week.
Very nice. Very nice. en tu pelo y te diera el verde prestado del llano y la cordillera de mi mano. Dios nacimos en nubes bajo los cristales y el rocío que mora.